There's a lot of evidence that property enhances economic growth. And property is also a very powerful rhetorical device. I'm sure you're all aware of intellectual property and the arguments made that intellectual property is like tangible property. So we wanted to look in detail at the institutions and the economics and the empirical evidence about patents as property. And one of the starting points is that property can fail. We look at, in natural resources, in land rights, situations where property has failed, things like the California Gold Rush or rights for mining different sorts of minerals. One example we looked at, in a litigious country, a property owner had to file no less than 43 lawsuits to defend one piece of property. Over 100 potential trespassers settled. They had to send out thousands of amnesty letters in order to enforce their property rights. So this is not an ideal type of property system, a well-working, well-oiled property system. But of course, the country that I'm talking about is the United States, and the property is patent number 4528643, widely known as the eData patent, titled System for Reproducing Information in Material Objects at a Point of Sale Location by inventor Charles Freeney Jr. And what this patent was, which was granted in 1985, was a patent on a kiosk in retail stores. We could go in, put your credit card in, select a music selection, and it would record it on a 9-track tape or whatever the technology was at the time. This patent was eventually purchased by a company called eData, and eData attempted to assert this patent over a broad swath of e-commerce. And the courts, in fact, upheld that their aggressive interpretation of this patent. Well, what's the problem with this sort of thing? Well there are really two problems. One is, if in fact property owners have to go to court lots of times to enforce their rights, then it's very expensive and it doesn't serve them very well. And on the other hand, there's a significant risk of inadvertent infringement, that someone who's an innovator who may not think that a patent on a kiosk in music stores relates to the e-commerce might be at risk of lawsuits that are being held up later because of fuzziness in the interpretation of these claims. So this is what we focus on the book. Now, of course, eData is an anecdote, and everything you hear about patents, and much of what you've heard about patents is anecdotes. We've heard about the peanut butter and jelly patent, about the patent on combing over hair. So we wanted to get beyond that and really say, get down to what's the empirical evidence. And the question we wanted to ask, it's a narrow question, but the question in the book is, do patents work as property? And what do we mean by that? How does property work? Well, the basic economic theory is that patents provide incentives. Incentives in the first place to invest in innovation. Incentives to take inventions and commercialize them. Incentives to trade inventions so that the parties who are most able to bring them to the consumer can utilize them the best. Well, then, if that's how property works, how does property fail? And so we look at a variety of mechanisms, but we focus on one which we think is most relevant to patents, and that is what we call fuzzy boundaries. Think about land. It very rarely happens that somebody builds a $1 million building, and then when they're done, finds out that, whoops, they built it on somebody else's land. No, they go through a process of clearing the rights. They know where the boundaries are. They get surveyors out there. They can tell where the boundaries are, and very rarely does that situation happen. That situation happens several thousand times a year now with patents, where somebody invests millions of dollars, they attempt to clear the rights, and for a variety of reasons they can't, or it is infeasible for them to do so, and they are then held up because they've, according to some court or according to some patent owner, allegedly have built on somebody else's land. So think about the eData patent. That patent in terms, you know, uses these very vague terms: information manufacturing machine, point of sale location, material object, and the courts go through a rather arcane procedure to interpret these things, which is not very predictable. So think about point of sale location. My experience in the computer industry in the 80s was point of sale location was what IBM and other companies referred to the place in the store that where they used to have a cash register. They replaced it with electronic terminals, and that was the point of sale location. It's where the transaction took place. But it was a retail application. So the question came up in this court case, what's a point of sale location? Is it only a retail location, or is it anywhere an internet transaction might take place, in somebody's office, in somebody's bedroom? And in fact, the court decided, yes, it's that broader thing. It could be in a bedroom, it could be in an office. And as a result, nearly 20 years after the patent was granted, it was given a scope that was far beyond what anyone could have predicted. Well, Mike and I focus on you know, what are some of the institutions that cause these kind of problems to arise? And this is we generally refer to as the notice or public notice problem. And the contrast with land is instructive here. It's necessary that property rights have publicly available boundary information. While the land deeds are stored in the county registrar's office, the patent office makes available patent documents, but it also turns out that there are procedures that are now widely used where patentees can hide the claim language of their patents for many, many years. Submarine patents and other things these are called. But there are procedures where the boundary information could be hidden from the public. The boundaries need to be predictable. I can hire a surveyor who can go out and tell me with a great deal of certainty what the boundaries of my land are, and that surveyor's opinion will matter in court. I can hire a lawyer for $50,000 to tell me whether my technology infringes a patent, but that lawyer won't guarantee that at all, and it has no weight in court, and there's really no way I can know for sure whether I'm infringing or not. In patent, possession is 9/10 of the law, or 9 points of the law, as the expression goes. Possession is very important because it helps us determine who the owner of property is. There is a possession requirement of source in patent law. But clearly, things have been stretched, particularly in areas like software and business methods and patents on mental processes, where somebody who invents a kiosk for a retail store can be the meaning of those boundaries can be expanded into something that is far beyond what the original inventor actually invented. And finally, it has to be the clearance process has to be low cost. When I go to check land, I can get a title insurance for a couple hundred bucks that gives me a high assurance that I have clean title to the land. People have estimated that to open up a web shop or do a web-related e-commerce site, you need to check over 10,000 patents. Infeasible. So software companies do not clear their products against all possible patents because they couldn't afford it. All right, so this is the theory. What's the evidence? And I'll just sort of highlight some of the stuff we go over. We look at a wide variety of evidence, historical evidence, cross-country comparisons, natural economic experiments. The thing we focus on is the role of litigation. Patent lawsuits have tripled since 1980. And this is of concern because of this issue of inadvertent infringers, that in our interpretation, most of the cost of that litigation falls on innovators who are trying to innovate, but inadvertently get caught up in allegedly stepping on somebody else's property. So we go through an economic calculation where we compare the incentives to the costs of disputes, and we measure the incentives from the profits of patents, and there are a number of economic ways we can estimate these. Essentially as the value of patents based on the behavior of patentees, based on the behavior of investors. Instead of measuring all dispute costs, we measure litigation costs, and we can measure these by looking at the reaction of public firm stock values when lawsuits are filed. Anyway, we put these together, and what we come away with is this. This shows a graph for the chemical and pharmaceutical industries. The blue line represents the profits in billions of dollars a year, and the red line represents the aggregate annual risk that those firms are alleged infringers. And clearly for these firms, they're getting a hell of a lot more out of the patent system in terms of incentives than they are in costs. But in every other industry, when we lump them all together, we find a reverse pattern. That until the mid-90s, costs and benefits were about the same, but starting in the mid-90s, the risks of litigation soared to a level well above any benefits those firms were getting from patents. But what was going on? What caused this erosion of notice in the mid-90s? And we can identify a number of legal changes. Perhaps the most significant is the expansion of the patent system. Patents being expanded to cover software, to cover business methods, to cover mental processes, to cover lots of things that were not traditional subject matter, and for which the law was not particularly well suited. Here's some evidence of that. About 1% of chemical patents end up in lawsuits. About 5% of software patents. About 14% of business method patents. Josh Lerner has estimates of financial patents that are five times higher than that. So the litigation burden falls very heavily in these areas. 26% of the lawsuits involve software patents. About 40% of the cost of litigation is attributable to lawsuits involving software patents. So that software patents and some of these other new areas are very much at the heart of, it's not the only thing that's going on, but very much at the heart of this breakdown in the patent system. Well, can it be fixed? I'll just touch on a couple things here. There is a patent reform effort going on in Congress, and we think this is a step in the right direction. A lot of the focus has been on patent quality, and quality is sort of a vague term, but people are focused, I think, on how well the patent office examines patents. We make a point that that's part of the problem, but that's only a small part of the problem, that there are really a lot of other things going on here that, if there are bad boundaries, the patent office can't do its job. So there's a much more intransigent problem that requires some much more significant changes. And sort of the key idea here is that a property system can really only be as strong as its limits. If you look at natural resource property, yes, I own my land, but there are limits to what I own regarding that. I don't own the oil and gas that flow under my land. I don't own the birds that land on my property. I don't own or can exact rights from the airplanes that fly above. There are limits that allow my property rights and land to be enforceable, but only because I've restricted the scope of what's covered. We tend to think that the problem is bad and it's getting worse, and this is just sort of a speculation that I'll leave you with, which is we charted over history the role of general purpose technologies in patent systems. So we looked at what percentage of patents use different technologies over time. And the second most frequent was electric motors. This is patents. The share of patents, I'm sorry, this is software patents. The share of patents using software, which is still accelerating, still going up. And to the extent that this is sort of at the nexus of some of the problems with litigation, we think the problem is only going to get worse over the next several years. And while we think some of the reform steps are a step in the right direction.
What is interchangeable?
Interchangeable parts was a major technological move. So we, in some of the early manufacturing techniques,
okay.
It started with the interchangeable parts in the rifle mm-hmm. assembly. And so this, the American system of manufacturers, as it was called, and I give you a history lecture,
but
mm-hmm. it was seen as a general purpose technology widely used. So I was one of the things we wanted to try. So that's, I'll leave you with that thought. I'm sure there are questions, so I won't feel imposed to prompt any.
recommendations for reforming? What would an ideal patent system look like?
Well, we're fairly frank that we don't know the answer. We have ideas about what direction we think it needs to go in, but we don't really know at this point whether those ideas will succeed or not. But we can give you some outlines, and I'll Mike, fill me in with what I don't cover. One thing is, I focused on software patents and sort of the expansion of scope. We think there have to be firmer limits on patents that involve abstract ideas or software. There needs to be some way to cabin the subject matter of patents so that they're not so expansive and they're not including things that are very vague and hard to pin down. That's one issue. There are a number of different ways that can be done in patent law, but that's sort of the general objective. There needs to be greater transparency so that the patents that are applied for, that very early on in the process one can obtain public documents that say what this patent application is claiming, and there needs to be it needs to be to have a predictable way of interpreting what those claims mean. There need to be fewer patents, especially in some of these new areas like software, where there are 200,000 software patents. There are just far too many for companies to check. One of the most effective ways of getting fewer patents, I think there are two things involved. One is by having stronger standards of non-obviousness, which the Supreme Court has started moving in the direction of. And the other is we think there should be much higher renewal fees on patents. So that patents that are not really very valuable don't get renewed. What did I leave out?
Well, with transparency, one thing that's probably not clear is that there's this process called continuation. You can keep rewriting the claim language. And the
PTO has considered limiting the number of continuations. Other countries in the world get along without this bizarre continuation process that we use. And the property right will appear suddenly 5 years after the initial patent application. In the Rambus case, that was a problem. It's often a problem. So that there's no analogy to tangible property where the rights can be rewritten. You can watch your competitors and write property rights that are going to be particularly effective against a certain competitor. That needs to be changed. England has started experimenting with opinion letters, and we think opinion letters produced by the English or the British Patent Office. We'd like to see something like that occur in the U.S. You can get opinion letters from the IRS or from the SEC, so there's a precedent for that. There are administrative agencies in the U.S. that will do something like that. Possibility of doing something like that in the U.S.
Who's issuing the opinion and about what?
We'd like someone in the PTO, an examiner, to give an opinion about the scope so that I have some sense about whether or not I'd be infringing.
I have a technology. I'm worried that maybe it infringes. I go and get a letter from them saying that.
So it's in response to a query.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. In England, they're doing that right now, both with a particular patent or with a body of patents. You know, greater cost for the second, of course. We'd like to impose a greater burden on patent prosecutors to make more of a disclosure. So, for example, a claim chart. Something that lawyers in fact routinely use when they're doing patent litigation, it would be nice to put that into the public record that is created during the course of patent prosecution, and a bit of a roadmap about prior art and how it relates to the elements or limitations within the claim technology. Those are reforms that will increase the cost of patenting. They'll have what we think is a desirable effect of reducing the number of patents that are applied for. It could have a negative effect of hurting, in particular, small inventors. There's something to think about there. I'm not really worried. I think it's a good idea, but that makes that debatable. And finally, I really emphasize, talking about reform, that we need to have a definiteness requirement. It's in the statute, but it's not in the Federal Circuit case law. Federal Circuit has absolutely no interest in invalidating a claim that is indefinite, and they should.
And then how far is the patent reform on Congress going towards meeting those?
They're not moving in this direction very much at all. One thing that they're doing that we like that doesn't address notice directly is limit the remedies available against innocent infringers. So the Supreme Court, rather than Congress, in the eBay case, perhaps made it a little bit more difficult to get injunctive relief against some worthy defendants. We don't yet know how worthy will be defined. The Supreme Court actually focused attention a little bit more on the patent owner rather than the defendant, but the language is broad enough that innocence as a defendant might make a difference in terms of availability of injunctive relief. Congress right now is talking about reforming the way that damages are calculated in patent lawsuits, and I suppose from our point of view, that's the most important reform pending. There used to be pretty frequent imposition of punitive damages in patent cases, and that was just nutty because many of the defendants are, as we said, are innocent. Innocent defenders have been slapped with punitive damages. It's because of their behavior after they've received notice of alleged infringement that gets them into trouble. The courts have started to reform this area of the law, and Congress might do some more. So, besides taking notice head on, reducing the number of patents and reducing the potency of remedies are the two other things that are good. And I just want to sort of general comment. If patents look like property, we might support strong remedies. Because patents often don't look like property, we're not so crazy about strong remedies.
Yeah, one other thing that we didn't... Congress is taking a half step in this direction, but we think in an independent invention defense, that, in other words, if I can show that I independently invented something and used it, you know, prior to the patent thing, I shouldn't have to pay anything to the patent holder because I invented this thing myself. That's been toyed with. We think that would solve a lot of the problems. It may not be the most direct way of doing it, but it may complement some of the others. And there are some limited prior user defenses in U.S. law and in European law.
Ask what you think are the chances for the Court of Appeals of the Federal Circuit to actually fix the mess, because it seems like the timeline we're talking about is the time when the Supreme Court handed off responsibilities for defining what is to the corporate.
Right. So in the last 2 years, the Supreme Court's gotten much more active. We're starting to see some signs that the Federal Circuit is moving in some good direction. They just announced that they're going to review a case which may have strong implications about business method patents and software method patents. On the other hand, this Federal Circuit seems to be a dysfunctional organization. On the issue of claim construction, the judges are bitter. I mean, you read some of these decisions and they're flaming each other about their approach to how do we interpret the claim. So it's not real encouraging on that front that they're gonna be able to solve this problem themselves. There are some people, and we have some sympathy for the argument that there really needs to be more than one appellate court in patent law.
So for whatever centralized solution you come up with, aren't there going to be compromises and trade-offs for different industries? Like a given patent arrangement may be better suited for one industry than the other, and a kind of one-size-fits-all model may not be the best way to go.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, so all of our evidence is showing these extreme differences between pharmaceuticals and most everybody else. I think that one possible outcome down the road is we have a patent system which covers pharmaceuticals and chemicals and not a whole hell of a lot else. That's one option, and I don't think it should be taken off the table. There may be other ways, but Pat, two law professors, Burke and Lemley, have argued that patent law does all this tailoring that is very industry or technology specific already. It's time that we recognize this and approach it affirmatively so that we have a system that really can be tailored positively towards different technologies.
To what extent do people bring in, stakeholders from various industries in terms of getting their input on what exactly they want to see to serve their interests in a patent system, and perhaps even getting funding for the patent system from them, since they're the ones being primarily served. Has anyone ever considered such a thing?
Yes, yeah, it has. So that people are, Jaffe and Lerner make the argument that in the, I guess around 1990, the patent office went to, it is funded entirely by fees, and that influenced their behavior. And in fact, at one point, there used to be a sign about up at the in the lobby of the patent office to the effect that, what was it, that we are here to serve our customers, you know, which is, no, they're here to serve society, not just their customers. If you look at what's happening in the legislation in Congress, you know, it's the pharma lobby is very powerful. There are all these powerful interests. There is this ugly scene going, you know, ugly activity going on behind the scenes about this clause and that clause, and people are influencing various details of the legislation. So there's clearly a significant political economy that goes on.
Lemley, Lichtman, and Sampad talked about having gold-plated patents, so two tiers or more expensive patent applications. That proposal, I think, was geared more toward validity questions rather than notice questions.
There's not much in it for a particular patent applicant to make their claim language more clear. You know, that's a harm that's spilling over to others. You might have an interest in having an enhanced, well, actually what Lemley et al. Propose is taking away the presumption of validity unless you go the gold-plated route. So there would be a positive incentive for applicants to seek that, but it's hard to put together a story where there are incentives for applicants to go out there and add clarity. The reason that's so true is that you can have multiple patent claims. You can have core claims that are pretty solid, and then you start shooting for the moon, you broaden and broaden and broaden what you claim and make it fuzzy in different dimensions, and you get to own all of those claims within a patent. So there's nothing but good, as far as you're concerned, in having fuzziness. So I can see a story that says that we can hook up private incentives of applicants to produce patents that where validity questions are more carefully investigated at the PTO. But I don't see the linkage when it comes to clarity, you know, unless we start doing punitive things, as we were suggesting, for example, invalidating claims that are judged to be indefinite. So that's what you need to do to provide an incentive to get applicants to come forward and lay down clearer claim language.
Well, you look at the number of patents, and did you examine the possibility of not granting patents for methods of doing business and not granting patents for software? Just like in the EU, you can't have a patent for methods of doing business.
No, we think that's definitely something that should be considered. There are a number of ways that you can restrict those. One is by a subject matter limitation. One is by maybe a weaker approach that some people favor. Deals with the enablement requirement, maybe limiting those patents to exactly what is described in the patent document. We consider those things.
Consider failure. I mean, do you consider also the issue of globalization as far as the enforcement of a patent is concerned? I mean, nowadays in a global market, having a patent in the one state doesn't necessarily...
Yes, yeah. No, we do consider that, and we're actually comparing the cost of litigation in the U.S. to the worldwide profits from the patent. So we're not including the cost of litigation in other countries. So we're sort of biasing it in favor of the patent system. But even then, we're showing failure. One of the things we find is there is this race to the bottom to some extent that seems to be going on in internationally in patents, that you find a lot of the lawsuits, European companies will file lawsuits in the US, even against other European countries, because the large companies, any valuable patent's gonna be taken out in Europe and in the US and in Japan, but the US has the laws that are gonna be most favorable to the patent holder, so they file the suit in the US, and they get a settlement agreement at some point in this process that covers the worldwide product.
Sometimes cheaper to do outside of the
United States. It's certainly cheaper, but it may be less favorable. But we've seen, if you look at the European countries, only Germany has more Europeans filing lawsuits against other Europeans than filed in the U.S.
Because Germany is the only country, more or less, when you start a litigation, you can really know more or less what you're standing in front of expense-wise.
Let me add a couple of rhetorical points. People who
are interested in patent law might notice that the Supreme Court is going to decide very soon a case that involves a Korean company suing a Taiwanese company. So, I mean, that's sort of emblematic of the globalization of patent litigation. And the ITC, the International Trade Commission, you guys might know about that. It's an organization that's supposed to protect American steel producers. Well, it turns out that a huge amount of the activity of the ITC also involves two foreign companies going after each other. So one foreign company is protecting American domestic industry from another foreign, one company is protecting American domestic industry against another company. No, it's because both of these companies will have their American offices, so that, you know, the ITC, which started out as being kind of mercantilist, now is just one more patent forum that is especially attractive to a lot of foreign companies.
Do you know what the actual impact on the economy will be, and whether people will be so incentivized to start businesses when there are so many hurdles to jump?
Well, we do some rough, some thumbnail calculations.
Yeah, the economy that we're almost coming.
The Patents Act is a tax. You can think of it as an innovation tax. And maybe it's a tax of 10%, maybe it's a tax of 15 or 20%.
So the value of R&D.
So it certainly makes companies less reluctant. It's not going to stop innovation, and we're not arguing that that's what's going on. But we think there would be more innovation going on and more investment in R&D if the patent system were fixed.
Inadvertent infringement. And sort of just thinking about your examples and stuff, especially the e-data price, it seems to me that there's sort of two components to definiteness and to inadvertent infringement. One is sort of just the definiteness of the claims at the time they're written, and the other is the fact that claims seem to sort of inherently expand over time, even though they look definite. So, for example, in the e-data patent, you know, point of sale, that probably sounded pretty definite at the time when it was made. It's just that sort of as technology progressed, people began to see other things. So, what do you think are the sort of relative importance of these two factors? And do you think there's any way to craft a definiteness doctrine that could actually capture some of those?
Right. The definiteness doctrine deals with sort of the problem of lawyering, of lawyers stretching the words. But you're absolutely right. There's a technological problem here, too. That we go through an example in the book. Well, one of the problems with software is people in computer science will understand that there are multiple representations for the same problem. So that the map coloring problem is also the traveling salesman problem. And historically, it's not at any one time, it's not clear what is equivalent to what technology is equivalent to something else. So people have talked about the Karmarkar algorithm, which was a patent AT&T got in the mid 80s. For doing linear programming, and at the time it was announced as a great advance, and AT&T was able to get some licensing revenues from this. 2 years after the patent was issued, some computer scientists figured out that this is really just an instance of a technology that was known in the 60s. So that it wasn't effectively innovative. But computer scientists didn't understand that at the time the patent was applied for. A patent examiner is not going to know that. A judge and jury aren't going to be able to figure that out. But here's this basic thing that property law requires us to know whether two things are equivalent or not, and we don't know that. So that there's a fundamental difficulty with abstract technologies, with software or business methods or mental processes that inhibit the effectiveness of any kind of property system.
Have you visited the fact that there are many people, especially in the open source community, that will purposefully not patent something for the purpose of ubiquitizing it? And is that a kind of failure as well?
Yeah, the patent system has always said, not long before the open source community, people have put things out in the public to essentially make them public knowledge so that nobody can patent them. And I don't think that fundamentally interferes with the process at all. It's I mean, I guess the analogy in land is deeding land to open access, or it's part and parcel of the same system. I don't it's neither contradictory nor at odds with. Yeah. Almost zero. And so we make the comparison in the book between land title insurance, which is cheap and easily affordable and reliable, to the insurance market. What you can get, well, there are certain types of insurance for patent holders. There are a couple of small companies. All the large companies have exited the market. There are a couple of small brokers who will sell you a policy that provides you a very expensive, very limited thing that covers only legal fees up to a certain limit. So you can get a very limited coverage, but you're not covering the business costs. The average patent lawsuit for public firm is something like costs $29 million. You're not getting anywhere near that, and you can't cover it.
Evidence that the market is really badly broken.
Yes. Yeah.
We make the point in the book that
if you are producing software, you can get insurance coverage that will protect you against a trade secret misappropriation claim and against a copyright infringement claim. But those insurers will not extend that insurance to cover patent lawsuits.
Yeah.
So the critical difference, I guess, is the availability of an independent invention defense. Independent creation is an absolute defense in copyright. There's no misappropriation in trade secret if you can document that you created it yourself, but that doesn't work for patents. So what we get is insurance regarding the first two kinds of IP lawsuits, but not the third.
How much of this do you see as an information aggregation problem? It's everything's very, very complex, and the computer people didn't know that the radio people had solved this problem 20 years before. Is there a Wikipedia-esque kind of solution to this whole thing, or is more aggregation and input of information not going to help this ultimately? I'm sorry?
Even if you could document it, you would open it up and it would be like, here are like the 4,000 things.
Well, I mean, I guess the place I'm going is would there be a role for people who really understand little niches and different things, and besides the people who are trying to make a living off of?
So there have been a number of efforts to sort of get the information to the patent office.
Right.
So there's a peer-to-peer patent project, which you may have heard about. There were some efforts in the 90s to build data. One of the first arguments about software patents was, oh, well, this is just a temporary problem. It's because the patent examiners don't know software. And for a while, the patent office wouldn't hire anybody with a computer science degree, so it wasn't helping. But they changed that, and what we find, actually, is that even though they've made those changes, the likelihood that a software patent will end up in a lawsuit is continuing to increase. It's not getting better. Some of the information aggregation helps, and we look positively on the peer-to-peer project. Basically, this is a way that people get to comment on software, pending software patent applications, and maybe get information to the patent office that the examiner doesn't know. But there are some real problems with understanding what the boundaries are. So some people have said, well, the eData patent, if the patent office had done a better job, they would have known that in 1983, there were people buying software over bulletin boards, and that was a kind of e-commerce that's covered. The problem is that I'm quite sure that the patent examiner read this patent application and saw that it was for a kiosk, and did not think that it applied to a bulletin board service, even though that was prior art, which could have invalidated the patent. So until you know what the boundaries are and how they will be interpreted, you can't know what you're comparing that patent to, and so the problem just blows up.
Under the status quo, when you hire the best people available to tell you what the boundaries are, they're not going to make a very good prediction.
Well, I think that there's still a problem with the volume that they're dealing with. It's like looking at, well, maybe you should spend 3 days on this, but with any kind of like government no, you have to do 8 of those today, so move them along. And I think that is part of the problem with the patent office, too.
Yeah. Well, it's a problem for clearance also. So Mark Webbing at Red Hat does this thumbnail calculation where he says, okay, if we want to take a new product and look at all the patents that might affect it, we want to study these patents. And to study each patent is going to cost us maybe $5,000. And then he does the multiplication and finds out that it's $1 billion for him to clear his product, and he has no hope of making, you know, anywhere that near that kind of return, and so they don't do it. 65% of the, in a survey, the intellectual property managers at the IPO, which is one of the patent organizations for large firms, 65% of them said that they don't always clear their products. They can't. And in software, you're not going to find a software company or a semiconductor company that even tries to clear its products.
An issue of liability. I mean, once they find out that there's something out there, so they're responsible to clear.
Right, so they could have treble damages. That could be an issue. That's part of it, but I think that's only part of it.
So there have been a number of works now, and materials that's going to be a very interesting one to add to it. That's really sort of the same sort of thing. You've said patents, particularly around software and business patents, are a problem. As you point out, our legislators don't want to be moving in a positive way. What do you think, how can we influence this through works like your own? And what do you think the next steps are? What would you advise the next steps are for a community that cares about the effect that this is having?
Well, I'm not sure what the next steps are. I think what's likely to, I think there's going to, basically, I think you're starting to see some movement. So maybe let me describe what I think is going on and where that's going, rather than, and that may clue us into where, you know, where we need to push things. But, our data are saying very strongly, this is a problem for ITC type companies. And what we're seeing for the first time in the last 2 years is that ITC companies, really for the very first time, are getting active in the lobbying process. They're still doing it, I think, in a very timid way. We're still, the action is really at the level of the, you know, vice president for intellectual property rather than at the CEO level. But if that hockey puck chart is right, this is going to become a problem at the CEO level more and more. And when we start seeing that happening, you're going to see them really taking a much more aggressive stand, and both the courts and legislative bodies are going to need to do something about it. Now, what I would like to see, so right now the positive action is being pursued by really a relatively small coalition of IP officers at several dozen financial, software, semiconductor, electronics, some media companies. The Coalition for Patent Fairness is maybe the most influential body. At the same time, there are a hell of a lot of hackers out there who have rather strong opinions. All the surveys about software developers about software patents show that depending on what field you're looking at, it's 75% to 90% think that software patents are not necessary. It's increasingly becoming a problem. Every small software company I know has patent issues of one sort or another. Or either that, or they're too young and they just expect to get them. they haven't gotten big enough yet or successful enough. So there needs to be a much broader coalition. There are a lot more people affected by this than, those 20 or 50 companies. And the effect of it is much deeper than just the IP office. But I think if the hockey stick continues, it's going to get us there.
But if you bring up the prices and they become prohibitive for small startups to get a patent, what protection would that?
The so well okay,
let me talk about small patents.
There are two issues here. What we suggest is a renewal fee structure so that the prices only become prohibitive several years into the process. So that lets a small, and you have lower prices for small companies to begin with, so that they can get in, they can get a patent very cheaply, but they've got a few years to prove it, to prove that it has value both to themselves, really to themselves, so that they pay for it.
To be fair, the comment I made, maybe Jim doesn't want to associate himself with this comment, but I actually do want to make patents more expensive for small guys, right from the start.
Yeah.
I want patent prosecution to be much more expensive. So I'm not talking about the fees that the U.S. charges. I'm talking about the fees that the patent attorneys charge. The patent attorneys are going to charge higher fees in my world because they have to do more work. They have to make better disclosures, and they have to write better patent claim language. And it will mean that small firms maybe won't get as many patents as they are now.
But as it is right now, with the prices that are current, the argument against a small startup getting a patent is a patent defense cost. They say even if you get a patent, you would never be able to afford to defend it. That's the point.
Right,
and now you want to make it even more.
Right. Our world might bring those costs down. I'm not sure. It would be too much for me to say that's true. But ideally, anyway, better notice will reduce patent litigation costs and reduce the volume of litigation. People will be more inclined to settle. You know, economists would take as an article of faith that clearer property rights are good for everyone because they reduce litigation costs. So, but I won't claim that. I don't know if that's really going to happen. So that would be optimistic to say at the back end.
But if you could have, I mean, your ideal reform would be one which would raise the initial requirements, which might raise the initial costs, but lower the back end litigation costs.
Have you looked at the consequences of that solution for the free software model? Obviously, that would pretty much kill free software for our economy, where you know people can't distribute software, which is one of the most popular free software licenses, GPL, with those restrictions. What effects?
Yeah, no, we haven't looked at it, but I would think that it's going to have a positive effect, but I have no idea how large.
Because if you raised, it would have a positive effect.
I mean, what?
You wouldn't be able to distribute software which infringed those quality patterns that you've sort of. Helped create through a more aggressive analysis. You're suggesting not to remove software patents, but to somehow have a better standard for writing them.
Oh, I haven't said anything about the validity standard. I favor a stronger validity standard.
I thought you were applying it broadly.
Jim and I are cheering on everyone that's trying to get a higher standard, but we just don't think that's the main problem. So we support any sort of reform that raises the 103 standard, like the Supreme Court's recent KSR decision, get better prior art before the PTO so they can do better examination. We like all of those changes. We just don't think that that's the answer. The second line of argument that we make in the book is that small guys don't, by and large, depend on patents. So most startups, when they go to the IPO stage, even in a lot of high-tech areas, don't have any patents at all.
You just said that you most hardly have any software.
Well, he's talking about problems.
Changing. Yeah, that's changing.
Yeah.
As of 1999, 21% of software IPOs had patents. The rest didn't. Venture capital firms, only about 20 venture capital financed firms, software firms, only about 20% had patents. In the late 90s. But I think that's changing now, where at least the companies that I'm in touch with, and this is just a casual survey, they're all somebody's told them that they're infringing a patent, they're getting the patents to defend themselves. I think it's changing fairly rapidly, but I don't have hard numbers on that.
Blowing the whole system up in certain sectors. What's the upside and the downside of that?
Well, there'll be a lot of screaming. Well, so say that.
That's
a tough question.
Well,
I'll jump in.
Softball, yeah. Sorry.
Levine was a person that commented on the book, right? There's Boulder and Levine are working on a book right now, a couple of economists who propose abolishing the patent system. And they looked at an earlier draft of our work and said, you guys are chickened out.
Yep.
You know, they said that based on the evidence that we've got here, we should be arguing for abolition. Yep. So, but they
have to describe it as a problem.
Yeah, well, the sectoral approach that Jim was talking about before is plausible. You know, I don't think I would go as far as Jim would, but, you know, it's pretty clear that we need, well, we don't absolutely need, but our system right now seems to be working pretty well in some dimensions anyway for pharma. Pharma is bringing in big rents, and those big rents really do seem to be funding R&D in the pharmaceutical industry, chemicals more generally, medical instruments. You know, there's a few other sectors where patents seem to be delivering rents that are big compared to the costs that they impose. And the classic complaint about sector-specific patent systems are that it generates a lot of rent-seeking. That's Jaffe and Lerner's complaint. So they won't go down the path that we've probably favor for software, which would be to go back to the 1970s and have some, within the doctrine, more severe limits on what kind of software is patentable. Jaffe and Lerner would argue that you're going to get lots of people using clever strategies to evade whatever the subject matter limitations are, and you'll turn patent law into copyright law. You know, if you look at how thick the copyright statute is, and you think about all of the industry-specific legislation and all of the bargaining that goes on, and you think, well, you know, we're pretty fortunate that we've got such a skinny patent statute. We haven't seen, up until now, very much industry-specific lobbying in Congress. And, you know, I'm not sure where I want to settle. You know, so I'm a little reluctant to go very far to having a pharma-only patent system. The one other problem is looking to the future. You know, technologies can change. This notice problem that we talk about could change very much as technology changes. And so I don't know if I want to lock myself into some kind of technology-specific or industry-specific patent system. I guess a final comment, arguing back the other way, Becky Eisenberg, final for me, not for Jim. Becky Eisenberg points out that the FDA could basically play the role of the PTO when it comes to pharma. You know, that what we really need is just FDA regulation. We don't even need a patent system for pharma. And so if we abolish the patent system, we'd still have the FDA, or for pesticides, we'd have the state EPAs. So we actually have entry barriers being created through the regulatory process that end up creating de facto patents.
Why is the regulatory process any better than a patent process?
Oh, I'm not saying it is better. I'm just saying that, I'm looking at the scenario of abolishing the patent system.
I mean, more generally, we should qualify what we say about pharma. We're only looking at a narrow question as to whether patents provide incentives. There's a whole secondary question, which is that still the right way to do it? I mean, there are a lot of people who say, well, you know, there are other ways of providing incentives for R&D in pharma or in other industries, and particularly in pharma, where they're concerned about drugs for malaria and the like, where people have raised up issues of contracts and prizes and awards. We do counter some of the Jaffe Lerner arguments in the book, talking about how, you know, the End Software Patents Coalition would like to roll the law back to 1981, and in the 1980s, there were restrictions on software patents, yet people did play those lawyering games to get patents covered on things, but it still kind of worked a lot better. You didn't have, you know, excessive litigation around those patents, perhaps because they were of somewhat questionable validity, and you didn't have a lot of lobbying like they predict. So it's not clear to me that, you know, those dire consequences of undoing something that the Federal Circuit did, you know, are necessarily going to be so bad.
If you completely abolish patent law, then theoretically for the industries where it's particularly useful, like pharmaceuticals, is it possible through coalitions of some sort they could enforce a functional equivalent of patent law? Like they could put pressure on people who take the formulas of others and they could tell their trading partners, don't trade with this guy through these coalitions, and it could not work.
So the way the industry is structured right now, we've got
the generic. I've asked some folks about why this is true, and I haven't gotten a good answer yet. But we have an industry right now that's got the pioneers and the generics, and the generics largely are not innovating. You know, by definition, they're not getting many patents. So I mean, their business model is simply to move in once patent protection disappears. And so, you know, the question would be, what would be, you know, what's in it for them? So it's hard to think about that sector. You know, traditionally,
but you know, the fact is the regulation does provide significant returns, so that what you find is that generic pharmaceutical manufacturers actually make levels of profit that are well above the average for a normal company. You know, so we think about generics being companies that compete very intensively and drive profits down to zero. In pharma, that's not true. And I think one of the main reasons is that generic manufacturers still have to go through a lot of regulatory hurdles to get there. And so that restricts entry into the market and elevates profits, which provide returns for doing R&D. I'm sorry, I cut you off, Mike.
Okay.
Well, maybe we should wrap up at this, unless anyone has a burning question. Thank you.
Thank you.